X-Talks connects professionals in the life science, medical device, and food industries with useful content like webinars, job openings, articles, and virtual meetings to help you succeed in your career. This Life Science Focus podcast brings together some of our editorial staff to share insights into the latest B2B industry news to keep you up to date.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. I'm Aisha Rashid, Senior Life Science Journalist at xtalks.com, and this week I'm joined by Sydney Perlmutter and Vera Kovacevich. Thanks for coming today. So we are officially in 2024, and let's talk about some of the trends that we can look out for this year in the life sciences. And so there are going to be a number of trends continuing, of course, from 2023 in the past couple of years. Of course, the pandemic was the biggest thing that afflicted society in general, and of course, the life sciences really catering and ushering in a lot of changes. And so those will continue into 2024 as well, lessons learned, and a lot happening in so many different fields, from drug discovery to medical device, health wearables. And so it's a very, very exciting time as we are on the brink of so many innovations in the life sciences that we can look forward to. And of course, technology really leading. And so as we step into 2024, the life sciences continue to evolve at an unprecedented pace. Again, like I mentioned, driven by technological innovation, which, you know, will be leading to deeper understandings of human biology and drug discoveries and so on and so forth. So let's take a dive into some of the trends that we can look out for this year. And of course, AI and machine learning have been one of the biggest stories, I think, across so many different areas. With the advent of things like ChatGPT, we're seeing really AI seeping into a lot of aspects in our daily lives already. So it's a very exciting time. And of course, these technologies are revolutionizing research approaches in the life sciences as well. And so since we have a lot of biological data being accumulated through, again, innovative technologies in the life sciences, there needs to be technology that can enable the analysis of this vast amounts of data. And AI and machine learning are definitely at the forefront of helping to analyze all of this data, which was previously unimaginable. And so as these technologies mature, you know, things like AI will not only help revolutionize drug discovery and development, but also aid in predicting disease patterns and developing personalized treatments. So to gain some insights into the world of AI in the life sciences, I contacted Joe Varshney, who is the CEO and founder of Verisim Life, and I was able to get some insights from her in terms of how technologies like AI and drug discovery and development are revolutionizing the field. So Verisim Life is the developer of an AI-powered drug development platform. And so Dr. Varshney said that since AI is billions of times faster than humans at analyzing and categorizing data, it can help researchers in medical research and drug development to quickly determine whether certain medicinal compounds will work together or not. So really, this could revolutionize how drug combinations are evaluated even before they go into trials. So the idea is that by using AI tools, you can predict and analyze how certain drug combinations may impact individual patients or groups of patients, again, even before they enter a trial. So that could definitely be groundbreaking, as it helps remove risk, which Dr. Varshney said is one of the biggest barriers to successful, cost-effective, and timely drug development. And so you know, as we all know, like 90% of drugs fail in clinical trials, and that is staggering. So only 10% of drugs that make it through that get to clinical trials are successful. And so that statistic really, again, is very staggering. And AI and technologies like AI and machine learning, again, have the potential to help improve these numbers. And so Dr. Varshney said that if a drug's efficacy and potential for adverse events, again, talking about risk and side effects, can be tested based on AI's broad understanding of human biology and chemistry, even before launching human trials, there is a possibility that more promising drug candidates can be saved from unnecessary failure. So this is pretty exciting because if you can predict which drugs, there are certain times where you may have a drug that seems promising in preclinical studies and then fails in clinical trials. But then you also have the other problem where you may have drugs that may not seem so promising in preclinical trials in animal models or in vitro studies, but perhaps that drug, you know, was cut at that point, but perhaps it might have success in human trials. So you may lose those drugs at the preclinical stage because they don't seem to be promising. And so technologies like AI, the idea is that they can really pinpoint and better stratify or better predict which drugs may do well in human trials. So that's really exciting. Again, the idea is to reduce failures and also significantly cut down current drug development timelines, which on average have been about 10 years or so. So that is also an area where AI technologies can help as well. So regulatory bodies are also taking note of the applications of AI in drug development. So in 2023, the FDA actually issued a request for industry comment on the integration of AI in drug and biologics development. And this is probably because the FDA received more than 100 investigational new drug submissions in 2021 that included AI and machine learning components. So again, we're really seeing these technologies in drug development, and the FDA is taking notice because they're receiving all of these applications with their use in them. And so Dr. Varshney said that in 2024, she believes that we could see an increase of these INDs with AI ML machine learning components to increase to around 400 applications. So another important challenge is that enhanced drug candidates may not fare well in the clinic. And Dr. Varshney said that this was seen in 2023 because a lot of the early application of AI has been focused on molecule discovery with far less adoption of its potential to guide translational research. So she says that in 2024, pharma companies and emerging biotechs will improve candidate safety profiles and reduce our off-target effects by exploiting predictive intelligence unlocked by AI. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, this kind of exciting cusp that we're at with AI, which seems to be so far reaching. And of course, in drug development, drug discovery, and also making its way into clinical trials. So through the whole drug development process, this could really be a game changer.
Yeah, for sure. I think like in all stages of drug discovery and development, you know, companies like VeriSim Life are trying to incorporate AI to just not only make the process faster, but honestly, like more effective too, because it can analyze large amounts of data faster. And what I really think is that it seems like VeriSim Life is focusing a lot on, you know, analyzing how drug combinations may impact individuals. So that's extremely beneficial for like cancer therapy. As you know, like lots of cancer therapeutics are given in combination with something else, right? So I think that has huge promise for oncology treatment. And something that what you were talking about, Aisha, was kind of reminded me of that concept of in silico clinical trials. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, where they're trying to model like how a drug is going to impact like a virtual human organ system, right? And so that's extremely helpful for like rare disease drugs where it's really hard to recruit patients and you can get a lot of insights that way. So really all along, like the whole discovery and development pipeline, they're trying to implement AI in some way. So I think it's really cool. And yeah, definitely a top trend for 2024 for sure. And I think you chose like a great person to interview too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the incorporation of AI, and we've had before, I mean, like you mentioned, in silico modeling, computational modeling of drugs, but I think with the incorporation of AI into that kind of modeling, it's just going to take it to the next level for sure. And yeah, I mean, are you guys like surprised that 90% of drugs fail in clinical trials? Like that, again, that statistic is eye-opening. And I think there hasn't been a lot of changes really in drug development, I think, for decades. And I think it's due time.
Yeah, I think this century will be like biology's century. And I think that hopefully that number will go down with the use of like simulation and AI. But yeah, 90% is a lot of drugs.
It does sound like a lot, especially for the amount of new drugs that do come out each year. It makes you think of, you know, how many potential new drugs could have come out during a certain time period. But I also think that it's a good thing in a sense, just because if there wasn't as much, you know, vetting and, you know, procedure that needed to be followed, maybe there would be more drugs on the market that weren't, you know, safe. But yeah, it's a large number. And I think cutting it down would certainly save a lot of money, a lot of resources, a lot of people's time, and, you know, make things safer as well. So I'm surprised, but I'm also not surprised. Yeah, sort of two minds on that.
Absolutely. I think those timelines are important as well. Financial considerations. So if 90% of drugs are failing, just imagine the financial costs to the industry in general. Like how it takes, I think I was reading the other day, I think it takes about around $2 billion to develop a drug on average. So there's a lot of money at stake. And if technologies like AI can help bring those costs down, I think it's a win-win because, you know, at the end of the day, getting drugs to patients and making sure that patients can access those drugs financially is a huge consideration. All right. So another trend that we will see continuing on into 2024 is the development of CRISPR-based gene editing therapeutics. So one of the big stories in 2023 was that we had the very first approval of a CRISPR-based gene therapy. So for sickle cell disease, and that approval was awarded to Vertex Pharmaceuticals and CRISPR Therapeutics. So the two companies jointly developed Casgevy or exa-cel. And so the companies received FDA approval for that last year. And so that was a huge story. And CRISPR Therapeutics, of course, is co-founded by Emmanuel Charpentier, who was one of the co-discoverers of CRISPR technology, along with Jennifer Doudna. And of course, these scientists received the Nobel Prize in 2021, I believe, for their discovery of CRISPR. And now to see, you know, taking their discovery of CRISPR, but the biology of CRISPR and now translating that into therapeutics and treatments, I think it is very, very exciting. And so, you know, seeing the very first CRISPR-based therapy receiving approval was a big milestone last year. And we're just going to be seeing even more applications for CRISPR-based treatments in the coming year for regulatory approval. And so there are several companies working in this space of CRISPR-based treatments, and some notable ones include Editas Medicine, and this company is focused on developing therapies for genetically defined diseases. And of course, CRISPR is a gene editing technology, and it's very specific, so that's why it's a very powerful tool in terms of the potential for developing therapies for genetic diseases. So Editas, again, is working on CRISPR-based treatments for conditions such as a rare inherited form of blindness and blood disorders as well. And then there is Intellia Therapeutics, which is notable for its in vivo CRISPR gene editing approach. And the company is working on treatments for diseases like transthyretin amyloidosis, which is a serious condition affecting the liver and nervous system. And then you have Beam Therapeutics, which is a company focused on base editing, which is a more precise form of CRISPR editing that allows for single DNA-based changes without making double-stranded breaks in the DNA. And then we have Caribou Biosciences. So this company is founded by one of the other co-inventors of CRISPR, Jennifer Doudna. And so her company is working on engineering immune cells using CRISPR technology for potential cancer therapies. And then Precision Biosciences is a company that uses a proprietary genome editing method that they've developed to develop treatments for cancers and genetic disorders. And of course, cancers and genetic disorders, as I mentioned, are the two biggest areas or applications for CRISPR technology. But of course, it can definitely be used to develop therapies in other diseases as well. And so these companies are at various stages of research and clinical trials with their compounds. And again, like I mentioned, in 2024, we're likely to see more advancements and potentially new CRISPR therapies emerging from these companies. And there are even more in the field. These are just a couple or several that I mentioned here. So yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on CRISPR and how it's really revolutionizing cell and gene therapies, the field in general, because before CRISPR, we had there was a big focus on immunotherapies in cancer, but CRISPR technology, seeing it just within a decade, going from a proof of concept thing in the lab to making it to the clinic and potentially treating patients now with the approval, as I mentioned, for the very first therapy that we saw last year. So yeah, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this new technology. And also gene editing, I think decades before we're actually seeing it today, but if we rewind back, there were so many, there have always been concerns about technologies involving genetics in terms of the ethical implications and what that means in terms of, you know, today we're also accumulating so much genetic data. And so there are a lot of ethical concerns around that as well. And also technologies like CRISPR, gene editing technologies, what if they fall into the wrong hands? And so there were so many considerations in this area. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, Aisha, well, to talk about your first point, so yes, the first CRISPR-based therapeutic was approved last year, Casgevy, that was developed by Vertex Pharmaceuticals and CRISPR Therapeutics, and that was given for sickle cell disease. And then I just saw today that Vertex Therapeutics got FDA approval for Casgevy again, except this time for the treatment of transfusion-dependent beta thalassemia.
Sorry.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I'll say, yeah. So it. I know that you mentioned last year when you were writing about the story that, you know, it's also under consideration for this other rare disease. So now they got it approved just today. So yeah, I think it's really exciting. And certainly more FDA approvals will come, probably even this year and next year. But to talk more about your second point, like, yeah, there is a big concern with like off-target effects mm-hmm. of these, like, you know, CRISPR-Cas9 therapeutics, because yes, they're designed to target a specific DNA sequence and correct for it for these genetic diseases. But for example, what if they accidentally edit other parts of the genome, right? Mm-hmm. And I know there's so many ways that the companies can test for this in their therapeutic development, and they're doing so, but there's always a concern, right? And I think from what I also heard, like the rare disease patients are really eager to get these technologies and these new therapeutics to them because it would potentially be like a one-time treatment that could be life-changing for them, right? So I've heard that the rare disease patients are really eager and brave too to want to try out this new technology. And it's because it's so promising. So regarding ethical concerns, what do you mean, like ethical concerns with these technologies? Can you give some examples?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an older topic, but I think it's still relevant. But in terms of designer babies and all of those concepts we used to hear in the past, you know, or people using genetic technologies for you know, not so good things, manipulating genetics and things like that, and using them potentially as weapons. And again, a lot of like things that are so far-fetched, but I mean, they have been of concern. But I think that was back when we didn't have any gene therapies approved. But now that we do, I think the climate kind of has sort of changed, because I don't really hear a lot about all of those sort of Frankensteinian kind of, you know, concerns really. So maybe now that we are here with actual gene therapies and approved, maybe the climate has changed. And Vera, to your point, yeah, you know, a lot of rare disease patients, advocacy groups as well, of course, for a lot of these patients, like they have, like a lot of these rare diseases have no treatments. And so these patients are, I hate to say the word desperate, but they really have no options in a lot of cases. And so there has been such a great push to get novel treatments and to get treatments to these patients. And it's been a concerted effort between industry, academia, patient advocacy groups, and patients themselves. So to see these therapies coming to light, I think it's credit to all of these players. And I think, you know, when I've spoken to industry experts, this is another theme that ties in with the approval of a lot of these new and novel therapies that we're seeing, is that it's been a concerted effort that has involved multiple stakeholders. So I think, you know, the patient centricity aspect of it is really important, seeing a lot of these therapies come to light.
Yeah, I was, when you were talking about the like ethical concerns, I was thinking like, of course, something like this could be abused or misused, and that, yeah, that designer baby like concern still is like a concern in certain ways, but I don't think that it should discourage you know, actual progress in terms of using CRISPR in that way. So yeah, I mean, is it, I'm just assuming that it's not really at the forefront anymore, but like, is the, you know, are these ethical concerns like still prominent in or prominent at all in this area of gene editing, or were there ever really ethical concerns in terms of, you know, providing patients with rare diseases some sort of help? Like, I don't even see how there could be ethical concerns there. Or was it just the use of that technology in
general? More of the abuse of the technology. And I believe Jennifer Doudna, again, one of the co-inventors of CRISPR, at length, actually, at some conference or a meeting she was at, discussing the ethics of genetic technologies like CRISPR. So it definitely still is a concern. But of course, when we're talking about the therapeutics aspect of it, I mean, this is game changing. And although, to your point, Vera, yes, there are still safety concerns with a lot of cell and gene therapies, because of off-target effects. And in fact, the FDA actually has launched an investigation looking at the cancer risk linked to CAR T-cell therapies. So that was in December last year. So there are concerns. Again, there have been rare cases where CAR T cells have been linked to the potential risk of cancers. And again, owing to off-target effects and things like that. So there are concerns, but you know, the fact that we do have regulatory bodies, you know, taking these concerns and looking at these risks seriously, I think is important. And yeah, as with any new technology, with any new drug, I think you need to have that oversight happening. And it's obviously it's a good thing that the FDA has taken notice. But again, we've had early iterations of CAR T cell therapies, gene therapies, and CRISPR. And so these are only going to get better and better, the technologies themselves. And I think those risks and safety concerns will be addressed as the technologies get better and better. Okay, let's take a look at the last trend that I talked about in my piece, and this is about next-gen health wearables with medical accuracy. So the global wearable medical devices market size was valued at $73.77 billion in 2023, and it's projected to grow to $428 billion by 2030. So that is quite staggering. And so the rapid proliferation of wearable technology for monitoring health indicators, again, has remained a steadfast trend for the past decade or so, and it will continue to be a major trend in the life sciences this year and beyond. So despite the massive continuing growth, the industry actually appears to have reached a bottleneck of sorts, because the limitation of a lot of these health wearables is that they are for health and wellness purposes, but they're not medically certified devices in most cases. So if you think about your Fitbit or your Apple iPhone, or, and, you know, tracking your steps, all of these are, sure, monitoring and tracking your health, different health indicators, but they're not medically accepted metrics, and they don't provide medical accuracy. And so to address this, a segment of health wearable developers are focusing now on designing devices with medical relevance and applications, so that if you do have a device, you can actually extract medically relevant information that you can discuss with your doctor, and then take appropriate medical interventions based on the data that's accumulated. So I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Anna Barnatska, who is the CEO and founder of MindMics, which is a company that's developing a wireless earbud heart health monitor. And again, I would suggest everybody check out this company, because I think what they're doing is very innovative, very, very cool. And so Dr. Barnatska told me that this is an exciting time for the health wearables industry. And she said that her company, MindMics, is focused on developing a medically accurate GPS for health. So she was talking about how we have a GPS to help us navigate to different locations. And so it's also important to have the same thing for our health. So Dr. Barnatska actually has a very interesting story. So and background, she was actually a NASA Einstein Fellow at Harvard University, and her research involved looking at black holes with precision instruments. And so working as an astrophysicist, she said that she was experiencing burnout and wanted to take a look at her health, but she looked around and saw that there were no wearable technologies in the market that were medically accurate enough. And so she decided to do something about it and founded MindMics to take health monitoring to the next level. So, Dr. Barnatska says that with a strong consumer market that is now demanding more with respect to user experience and medically relevant insights, what we need now is the technology that will be able to give us medical accuracy for wearable technology. So, for heartbeat measurements with conventional photoplethysmography or PPG optical technology, so that's the technology that's used in most current health wearable devices like watches, a lot of information is lost. So, to address this, MindMics uses in-ear infrasonic hemodynography technology, which in simple terms is based on the detection of sound waves in the ear canal produced by blood flowing through the vascular system. And so the sound waves that are propagated to the ear canal have very little distortion of the signal, giving heartbeat measurements as accurate as invasive cardiac catheterization procedures. So the problem was, though, Dr. Barnatska said that in developing this technology, since these sound waves are below 20 hertz, existing technologies and industry standards were not equipped to detect sound waves below this threshold. So the company had to innovate, building an infrasonic lab to validate and build standards to be able to evaluate the components, microphones involved, and all of that with this earbud in this range, so below 20 hertz. And fittingly, she said that it was essentially a black hole below 20 hertz. So they were able to successfully develop this product, this system, and again, a whole lab infrastructure around it to be able to validate this device and to be able to detect sound waves below 20 hertz. And data from the earbud monitor is then sent to the cloud where it's stored and analyzed, providing real-time results and actionable insights. So again, this is monitoring your heart health by using sound waves detected in your ear, which I thought was super cool, very innovative. The technology was there, but again, MindMics took it to the next level by being able to really hone in on the threshold below 20 hertz and to really take that technology. And again, it's comparable to invasive cardiac procedures. So in terms of the data that you get from it, so a very robust heart monitoring system indeed. So Dr. Barnatska also noted that an important trend for the industry is to think about how to make preventive health a good business model. So she said that current models are focused on treating diseases, but long-term prevention is a key way, of course, to reduce costs. But unfortunately, she said that as of today, it's still difficult to convince payers that prevention is where it's at. And so she said that there was a lot of work to be done on that side because it's better to work on prevention than to cure or treat diseases. But again, that business model isn't there, and she said that we have to shift that mindset, which I thought was very enlightening and, of course, an important aspect for sure. So, yeah, I think really fundamental to many of the trends and innovations that we're going to see in 2024, as we talked about, is the adoption of cutting-edge technologies that will enable revolutionary discoveries and solutions. And I think this technology, this device from MindMics is definitely an example of this. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this technology, health wearables as a market, and in general, if you use health wearables in your life, and are you also ready to move into the next dimension of medically accurate health wearables?
Well, I personally don't use any health wearables, but if I do, I would like to know that they've been like FDA approved or Health Canada approved for that specific purpose or monitoring goal. Just because to me that adds like an extra layer of like validity and I just feel like I can trust it more. So to me that's important if I was to use one. Like I want to make sure that it's been approved for that purpose. But I think like yeah, they're becoming quite popular, and I think it's mostly because of like the Apple Watch. Maybe do you guys have any other companies or watches or wearables at the top of your head that you can share?
I mean, Fitbit is like the biggest company, I believe, still
Fitbit,
in
okay.
the area in the area. But yeah, I personally actually don't use any health wearables either. But again, because I also just personally saw it as, as a which they are currently mostly as just health and wellness, trackers that will track how many steps you've taken in a day, which is all fine and great, but do we really know what those metrics translate into medically? Like if you 10,000 steps, what does that mean for your heart? What does that mean for your respiratory system? Like we don't have that information. So we have all of this data that we're collecting, but we can't really do anything with it, and we don't have those medical insights to be able to make decisions. So I think the industry is taking a leap towards that next step, which I think is really great to see because now you can actually take health indicators and measures that you've collected and actually take them to your doctor and discuss them. It's like now, it's like if you take your 10,000 steps to your doctor, right, they're not going to really be able to give you anything. And so I think the idea re really is to, or the idea is to have medically accurate information. And with that, like you said, Vera, to have FDA approvals and regulatory approvals backing a lot of these devices, or the next gen of devices that will be coming out. And also, I found what was very interesting that Dr. Barnatska mentioned was about prevention over treatment. And I think that's often overlooked a lot, where the industry, a lot of industries in the life sciences are very, very focused on treatment and drug discovery development, which is, of course, important. But there are, what are the strategies and approaches that we can develop, to address prevention? And I found her insights on that topic to be very interesting in that we don't have business models because essentially, at the end of the day, from an industry perspective, it is a business. And so prevention can become a business, which I thought was very cool. So there is money to be made, in every aspect, and prevention, can be one of them. And that's important for us and for patients at the end of the day. So I thought that was an interesting insight. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I love that insight. I do think that the way the business model is organized now, not just in the US, but in Canada, it's like it's up to the patient to go and say, "Oh, I'm due for my colonoscopy," or "I'm over this age, now I can get screened for this," or "Oh, it's time for my annual physical exam," right? It's always on the patient to take the initiative. And sometimes I feel like if they were contacting us and telling us, "Oh, you're due for, I don't know, a pap smear." I know that in Ontario they started to do that to women now. But if they were to do that for everyone, and just like a if they were to take the initiative, I feel like patients would listen and follow instead of the patient has to take initiative for their own health. And many times when you yourself have to take the initiative, typically, you won't go unless you feel like there is a problem. And at that point, it may be a little bit late and you may have to go on treatment. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think if they were as persistent as dentists in terms of getting you to come to appointments, then it could be a lot more effective. And yeah, I think prevention even starts at like, oh my goodness, there's so many levels to it. I think it starts at like just basic education as well. Like even when you're young in elementary and grade school and high school and whatnot, I think, because learning, obviously you can't learn about everything that could possibly go wrong with you, but I think like teaching the importance of checking in, like having, annual checkups and taking certain tests at certain periods in your life, like I think that's so important too, because I think, yeah, we as patients find out that we need to do a lot of these things either by happenstance or we're told by like friends or something comes up and we have to go to the doctor rather than like knowing that these are the things that we need to do. So yeah, I agree. And there is a lot of money to be made on the preventative side as well. So I don't think there's, you know, the business of healthcare needs to worry about that as well, because there's definitely money to be made.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, definitely agreed. And I think, things are getting a lot better in terms of screening. You know, you will get things in the mail about, okay, you're due for this test or that test. But I think there is still a disconnect in terms of like, you know, patients not maybe fully understanding why they need to get that test, you know, and what it's going to do. Like, for example, a colonoscopy, it's probably one of the best preventative diagnostic treatments, because, you know, if you have polyps in your colon, those can be taken out, removed right during the colonoscopy. And so you can prevent those from potentially becoming cancer later down the line. And I don't think a lot of patients know that, right? So I think there's a real disconnect between education and the tools and screening tools that we have. And I think that needs to improve for sure. And in the context of these health wearables, the next gen health wearables that we're kind of talking about, is that they can help in a lot of these preventative measures. You know, if you see something abnormal on your heart monitor, your earbud heart monitor, you'll be, you know, alerted and you can take action to do something about it. So I think that's going to be very powerful and really putting the power in patients' hands to really take action and have agency over their health. All right. So that was an overview of some of the trends that we can expect in 2024. And of course, there are a lot more exciting things that we can expect in the coming years in the life sciences across the pharmaceutical, biotech, and medical device sectors. All right. And so that brings us to the end of the Life Science Podcast. Hope you liked today's show. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you did. Thank you, everyone, and see you all next week. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the X-Talks Life Science Podcast. If you enjoyed our discussions today, please share the episode with your friends and colleagues, and be sure to subscribe in order to be notified when a new episode is released. To join in on the discussion, you can find X-Talks on social media, email podcast@xtalks.com, or comment on the articles directly. Links are in the show description. Take a moment to join our community at xtalks.com to get access to everything we have to offer, including webinars, job listings, virtual meetings, articles, and more. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers sharing them. They should not be taken as professional advice and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position Honeycomb Worldwide. For further information, email us at podcast@xtalks.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.